Silicon Valley has historically not been the most welcoming of places for women. That is not news, but today's guest wrote the cover story for the April issue of The Atlantic and aimed to find out why. Liza Mundy is a writer for The Atlantic and Politico, author of the forthcoming book Code Girls. Welcome to the show, Liza.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your cover piece, Why is Silicon Valley So Awful to Women, is an amazing long-form think piece about a topic that we've been over and over on this show more than I think many of our viewers would like. But I really believe that your piece is different. It goes deep into why not much has changed, even though so many of us agree that it should. Now, one of the arguments I hear often when we talk about this topic is there aren't more women in tech because of how we're treated, but because most women just, they don't like tech that much. It's just not their thing. Now, you interviewed dozens of women for your article. How do most of them feel about the tech parts of their tech jobs?
Women love tech. It's true that they leave the tech industry at twice the rate that men do, but generally when they do that, they go into tech-related jobs in other industries so that they continue to use their tech skills. I mean, tech is a great field. There aren't that many fields where you can do really interesting problem-solving work, likely make a six-figure salary, and often not even need a graduate degree. That's really unusual. So the women love the work who I interviewed.
And so now you've written many books, some about technology fields, some most of them not. Is this something that is the way that women are treated in technology, or the rate at which women leave tech jobs, is that markedly different than other fields, or is it pretty similar?
Well, I don't know if this is a direct answer to your question, but one of the things that intrigued me about tech, I've written about other fields where women are still in a distinct minority. One of them is the U.S. Senate. So when you look at the Senate, you can look at hundreds of years at this point, more than 100 years, of exclusion of women, you know, a period of time when women couldn't vote, when they couldn't get their party's endorsement. So all sorts of historical reasons in something like politics why you don't see more women. If you look at fields like law and medicine, these are fields where, again, for hundreds of years, women were excluded from graduate schools. They were excluded from professional societies, associations, various forms of accreditation. So in some fields, there's a long history of exclusion that, you know, still makes it hard for women to break through. Tech was always intriguing to me because it's a young field. It's a new field. It doesn't have a century-old history of excluding women. It's a progressive, right-thinking, future-oriented, problem-solving field. And so what is so puzzling is why would a field like this be really as difficult as the U.S. Senate is for women to break into?
I wonder, did you have any insight in reporting out this story at maybe a bit of intersectionality here? Obviously, tech and Silicon Valley have a young history of being awful to women, also people of color. But it seems like there's this national dialogue that's happening these days with Oscars So White and why tech is not great with different minority groups. And you know, in journalism, we talk about diversity issues all the time as well. So I wonder, you know, looking at the intersections and the problems in all these different fields, does it feel like maybe this is a time where genuine change could happen because of this dialogue? Maybe because people are willing to admit that some of these problems are really there?
Yeah, I mean, one can hope. I think the signs of hope are the fact that there's more transparency now. The big tech companies have started publishing their diversity figures. They're changing and improving incrementally. They are getting a little bit better, not fast, but a little bit better. So yeah, there's more conversation about it. There's more transparency. There are more advocacy groups. There's more sort of internal and external pushing. Organizations like Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Push organization, you know, were among the earlier groups trying to get tech companies to publish their numbers. There are also green shoots of change in some computer science programs at Stanford, at Harvey Mudd College, at Carnegie Mellon, the percentage of female undergraduate majors in computer science is getting closer to parity. So the sort of old pipeline excuse that that companies use, yeah, we would hire more women if they existed, but the pipeline just makes it hard. That that argument, you know, for the big companies, that should never be true, because Google, Facebook, they're such desirable places to work. They should be able to get a disproportionate percentage of the pipeline anyway. But now that some major computer science programs are really producing significant numbers of female undergraduates, I think that's a sign for optimism, and it certainly shoots down the pipeline argument.
So another argument here is that, you know, a lot of jobs like, you know, lawyers and CEOs, it's about temporal flexibility, that, you know, you have to be in the chair, you have to be, you know, your client has to have access to you immediately. And women often don't choose those jobs because they make a different choice. So the people that you talked to for your article, were these like C-suite jobs in technology, or were you talking about all the kinds of jobs? Because when I think about Silicon Valley jobs, they're all about temporal flexibility, you know, there's just so many ways that you could, you know, work after your kids go to bed, you know, take your kids go to school and then, you know, and then work. So did you talk to people mostly C-suite level jobs in this piece, or was it across the board?
It was across the board. And that's the other puzzling thing about Silicon Valley. I mean, it's all about work-life flex balance, maternity leave, paternity leave. We'll freeze your eggs if you want. I mean, there's so much conversation around work-life balance. And I know it doesn't always feel that way to employees. I've heard that, you know, paternity leave is a great gift for working mothers, right, to encourage men to take time off when they have children and to be active partners. That's a big boon to women in the workplace. And I know that even though these companies offer it, people don't necessarily feel that they can take it. But even so, tech is more than almost any field I can think of, tech makes a big deal about work-life balance. So the people that I talk to that feel, you know, uncomfortable in their office settings or have had difficult interactions, it's never to do with work-life balance, ever. It's to do with how they're treated.
You also spoke with a number of entrepreneurs, women who are starting their own businesses to really kind of answer and solve a lot of these problems, including Bethany Blunt, the CEO of Kathy Labs, and Stephanie Lampkin, the founder and CEO of Blendor. How important is entrepreneurship into, you know, finally cracking these seemingly insurmountable issues in Silicon Valley?
Well, it's important, although the thing that I was struck by is, and Bethany actually recounted one of the anecdotes in the piece, even when women are in positions of authority, their technical skills are challenged. She talked about conducting an interview when she was a senior tech person at an, you know, online gaming company, and came in to do an interview with a applicant who was really disrespectful in the interview to her, disrespectful to a female vice president. And then they sent in kind of a young new male employee to do the interview just to give him some experience giving interviews. And the applicant treated him with much greater respect. So even when women are in positions of authority, it's surprising that they still find their expertise challenged. And similarly, I talked to women who themselves are now investors and investing in companies. And the sort of the needle they have to thread in terms of being friendly and being cordial and congenial with the boys club of money and funding, but fending off relentless advances and, you know, invitations if you're having dinner to come up and have a drink in the hotel room. Or she talked about, as an investor, being told by a startup founder, if you want to get in on this deal, you'll have to spend intimate time with me. So entrepreneurship obviously is incredibly important in this industry, but women entrepreneurs and even women funders, it's really striking to me, again, how they get treated and the sort of environment that they have to navigate. One thing that I think is maybe different about tech is a lot of the interactions in tech, a lot of the meaningful interactions take place in workplaces, not in workplaces. Take place at conferences or in funding situations where you're making a pitch or you're socializing. And so, you know, workplaces these days can be somewhat regulated. At least there might be a HR department that's paying attention. But a lot of these interactions are not even taking place in offices.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, last month, Susan J. Fowler, who wrote the piece on her blog post about her year at Uber, which was just really amazing. Like, you know, as much as you thought Uber was an old boys club, like just to read the things that she went through and reporting sexual harassment and then, you know, having being told that this was the person's, you know, first experience with this and then talking to other women and finding out that, you know, it happened so often. You mentioned in your piece a lot of things that people might not think about as issues. Talk a little bit about the open floor plan.
Right. So, and I will say Uber is a good example that even when people are in workplaces that have HR departments, you know, that's not a recipe for success, and that HR departments can be a place where complaints go to die. So it really does have to come from corporate leadership and from the top. There's this culture in Silicon Valley of what was called creative confrontation at Intel, and it was sort of invented after the war. The idea that a productive intellectual environment is one where there's lots of arguing and lots of conflict and lots of criticism of other people's ideas. And so I interviewed women who, again, love the work, love the tech that they do or still in the industry, but worked in open office environments where one woman said there was this male employee who was constantly popping up behind her to find fault with her work and to look at her computer screen. And so she didn't even feel within the office that she had a place where she could go and feel safe. And I think particularly in offices where there's a lot of arguing and that's kind of the ethos, for anybody who feels like they're an outsider, like they're not part of the club, that's just even more difficult.
Mm-hmm. So last May, we interviewed Ellen Pao and Erica Joy, who started two of the founders of Project Include. You talked to some of them as well. Is what they're doing, they've been around for about a year, is what they're doing, how's it going for them?
You know, I interviewed most of the members about their own personal experiences. I think that as opposed to, you know, sort of granular detail about what Project Include is doing, although I think that what they're doing is really trying to find ways to get even more granular transparency and to work with companies that are really interested in digging down into their demographic figures and understanding why they lose women at certain points in the career path. And I think they're one of a number of organizations that are looking for ways to bring more data to bear on the problem. And also the fact that the women on the board were so willing to talk to me about their experiences is really, really important, because I did interview women who were still quite reluctant to talk about their experiences, which I totally respect. But I admire all the women with Project Include who were willing to just go ahead and talk about it.
I wonder, did anyone speak to some of the problems that do exist in tech with the way men behave? I mean, obviously what we want is parity and for women to be treated equal, but there are some things that are accepted norms for men in Silicon Valley that might not be acceptable in other places. Quite frankly, there's a lot of CEOs who behave badly and are sometimes celebrated for being aggressive and for being jerks. I don't know if this is something that these women are looking to fix, or if this is something that they aspire to have the freedom to do as well.
I'd say fix. I didn't talk to any women who wanted to be able to behave like sort of, you know, the most egregious examples of kind of fratty behavior. I didn't find any women wishing that they could emulate that.
Was there anything, well, I just, you know, just got to know, was there anything that came about in your reporting that didn't make it into the article that you wish, you know, would have been able to get in there?
Well, as you said, it was a long form narrative, so there's a fair amount in there. I think, that's a good question. I could endlessly report this topic, but I felt as though we were able to pretty thoroughly cover it, actually.
So tell us about your book that's coming out, Code Girls.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for asking. I'm just putting the finishing touches on the manuscript. It's been a fascinating story. And I think it's important in this realm. During World War II, after Pearl Harbor, which was came as a great shock to the country, and we realized that we needed to improve our intelligence gathering by breaking codes that enemy governments and diplomats were using around the world, the men were all shipped to sea. So actually, a little more than more than 10,000 women came to Washington for the Navy and the Army and broke the codes all during the war. There's been a lot of attention given to Bletchley Park in England, but the American code-breaking operation was actually bigger than England's and shortened the war probably by 2 years. And it was majority female. I mean, more than half of the codebreakers were women. And they... some of them are still alive. They're in their 90s, and they've never talked about it. They took their vow of secrecy very, very seriously. They understand it's okay to talk about it now. And I think they are an important example, actually, for women in STEM and women in tech. A lot of this had to do with math. An important example of how women actually have been contributing in these fields all along. They just haven't gotten the attention, really, that they deserved. It's been a fun story to report.
Of course, it's so important to have mentors to see to read those in your history books as you're growing up and just to see what's possible. Thank you so much for joining us, Liza. Liza Mundy is a New York Times bestselling author, a fellow at New America. She is at Liza Mundy on Twitter and can also be found at LizaMundy.com. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Good night.